Hallo, liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer einer weiteren Folge der Interviews for Future, des Podcasts der Leipziger Scientists for Future, heute auf Englisch. Hello, dear listeners, for our podcast Interviews for Future of the Leipzig Scientists for Future. Today I have here Indy Joha. Hello, Indy.
Hi, hi Dominic, how are you doing?
So, oh, fine. It's a bit hot here. It's above 30 degrees in the rooftop. So, but I like it personally. So, and you're fine. You're still in Berlin. You said.
Yeah, I know. I'm in Berlin, and it's nice here. It's good weather. I'm enjoying being in Berlin. So it's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. Yeah. The next day, the weather should be much better. We have a little heat wave.
Well, yeah. I have to say, I'm not. I like it a little cooler.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe the park. You will find a place. Yeah. First about you. So you're in general you're architect. That's right. And founder of.
That's right.
Founder of Dark Matter Labs, and you did something more here and there. And so as I researched, it looks like you're mostly interested in how to build cities or how to rebuild cities in the fact of climate change and what it makes that we have to change something.
Yeah, so I trained as an architect, and but I also ended up working with people like Demos, which were a policy think tank at the kind of during the late 90s and early 2000s. But actually, fundamentally, what I've been interested in is how do you democratically build cities and the democracy of our cities in a deep sense. And by democracy, I don't mean the vote. I mean the capacity to build society together. And I think one of the big challenges that we face is that we're going to be entering a new age of volatility, a new age of very large levels of uncertainty. And how do democracies, how do we democratically make these transitions is, I think, one of the most difficult problems that we're talking about. Autocracies have the capacity to be able to top-down control their transition. And typically in war, in places of uncertainty, we resort to autocratic systems. And the question I think democracies face, and especially in Europe, especially here in the heart of Europe, is how do we democratically make this complex transition at speed? And our theory of democracy, which is through government, is actually very limited, because actually government takes 4 years to make a decision, or 18 to 24 months. And when it makes very rapid decisions, actually the frameworks of legitimacy, the frameworks of how decisions are made break down. And so, you know, increasingly when I speak to government officials, they talk about government via WhatsApp. And the reality is when government acts through WhatsApp, it's vast, incredibly vast, and incredibly powerful. But actually the legitimacy structures break down of how do we make decisions, how do we build accountable decisions. So I think in terms of dealing with the transition, one of the big fundamentals is how do we make decisions as societies, and how do we build societal agency in a new way in this transition, I think is a really fundamental issue.
So you said a few times these fast speed we need. It's really, really time pressure we are in, for sure we are in. I see sometimes people have a fear of, because this pressure makes, as you said, a bit the possibilities of autocratic is easy. You make top down and then it's working. So we see it in China with solar and wind energy as an example. But that's not what you want. Do you see this time pressure as a big problem on the way to make this democratic, or is it more a chance, or like?
Yeah, I see the time is breaking, the time is challenging our current model of democracy, of how we make societal decisions. I don't think time is the problem. Like I think you could look at COVID and some aspects of the COVID frameworks where, for example, government, you know, the best of governments were saying with honesty they did not know the full extent of the problem. They were honest about that. They were then making decisions with scientists real time. So they were actually building a science and a political framework as an integrated idea. And they were changing their opinion. And we understood that politicians needed to change their opinion as the facts changed. So you could see that there was a new architecture of how we could make government. Now, the question is, that was still top down, but it was certainly agile. It was certainly responsive. The question is, how do you build a different model? So how do you build the citizen science around this story? How do you build the citizen quantified self of these transitions? So too often we are only looking to empower the intelligence of politicians. Actually, I think one of the big questions is, how do you build society which has a scientific quantified self background? So how do we get citizens to understand the butterflies, the lack of butterflies, or the lack of insects, or the lack of, or the energy and the implications of carbon, or the water air quality issues, the noise quality issues? So we build this sort of citizen science, and to allow for a new political theory of change to emerge from the back of it. And I think we've underinvested in constructing the demand at the citizen level and the sensing and the sense-making and the decision-making capacity of citizens. And we've focused too much on opinion orchestration. So we focus too much on saying, what do you think about something, rather than building our knowledge capacity to for us to become aware of the issue in a deep sense. And I think there's a fundamental question about how do we deal with complexity by building that side of the story.
In Germany, we had the same, yes, for sure, at the COVID pandemic. I don't see at the moment, a bit maybe, but not really, that in Germany, especially the climate science is so deep influencing into politics as it has to be. How it is in Great Britain? You're based in London normally. So
yeah. So I think the problem is that we only influence the politicians. And my point is that I think we have to build the citizen knowledge base. And I do not think we invest significantly. You know, like, for example, a good example is if you went driving with your parents in this, I don't know, sort of late 70s maybe, and you would see that the front windscreen of the car would be covered in insects.
Yes. Today not.
Right. Today not, right? Now, that awareness is saying us something about the massive biodiversity loss that we've seen in our system. Now, and I think it's building that level of consciousness at the citizen level of our day-to-day experience. And, for example, and how you see the world around you. So, for example, a tree is not biodiversity.
Yes.
Right? a tree, which then a piece of timber which is lying next to that tree, and that timber is decaying because it's being eaten by, you know, consumed by mushrooms and other things. And then insects are growing over it, and those birds are coming to eat the insects, and those insects also have small animals. That is what creates biodiversity. It is that life cycle. So we often are very happy to plant trees as symbols of biodiversity, but we haven't created the conditions for those ecosystem loops to happen. And without those ecosystem loops, you don't create biodiversity, and then you don't have a method of understanding it. So how do we build a deep citizen awareness of our internal environment, how we sense our internal environment, the microbiomes of our internal environment, the impacts of light pollution at night on our sleeping patterns? Building that awareness constructs the demand for politicians and the capacity for politicians to make new decisions. And I think too often we focus on politicians making new decisions, but actually I think we have to build the citizen awareness and consciousness to allow for new decisions to be manifested. And we already know, for example, if you ask people, you know, we did a piece of survey where we got loads of people off the street to ask about universal basic income. The first question we said was, they came off the street, literally, what do you think about universal basic income? 70-odd% of them said, we don't like it. They looked around the room and said, we don't think it's a good idea, everyone's going to get lazy. Then they spent the day together deliberating. And at the end of that day, it went to 84% people saying they thought universal basic income was a good idea. I thought this was because they had spent time thinking about it, learning about it, but actually no. The more fundamental issue was that the people in the room were no longer othered. So the people that had come into the room, they was like, who is that hairy guy with a turban who's going to, well, I don't want him to have money, he's going to go lazy and just drink and sit down. Whereas actually once they spent time with each other, they were no longer other, and they recognized each other as similar. And as soon as you saw each other as similar, their decision matrix shifted from being about othering to being actually recognizing self-similarity and seeing each other in everyone. And that changed their opinion. So how we create decision-making models, how we create sensing models, fundamentally constructs the politics of our transition. And I think democracies have to build new infrastructure for these transitions.
To bring this back to biodiversity, are there concrete plans or concrete ideas how to bring this topic to bring together? Because it's the same with the insects. So if you never had insects in your life, then it's only aggressive wasps, and I buy a toxic and spray it and away. So for sure we need this connection too. So it's where's the open door for cities especially? To bring more biodiversity as only the trees in interaction with the people.
Yeah, and this is why I say that climate change is a symptom of the problem, not the problem itself.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The more fundamental problem, as you rightly say, is our relationship with the world. And what we've created is a framework where humans have become both in dominion of the world, in control of the world, but also separated. So we do not understand that we're fundamentally entangled. I think there's, you know, grass DNA in each one of us too, all sorts of other. Like if you look at our DNA structure, it's an entanglement with life itself. And if you look at our microbiomes, they impact our decision-making models. We are quite systemically entangled to the planet. We are the planet and the planet is us. And the idea of the human isolated in space with a spacesuit and being able to survive is quite an illusion relative to actually the depth of the entanglement. So I think one of the big philosophical questions is reimagining our entanglement with the planet and recognizing that interdependency. And that's a sort of a 400-year crisis of actually how we distance ourselves. And the second part of that is then actually reorganizing our institutional imaginaries like ownership ideas. So we own things or we control things, our theories of control-based linear production models, which are all based on control and linear futures and theories of resources, seeing nature as a resource, seeing human beings as a resource. I think this language and this social imaginaries, as Thomas Bjorkman calls them, is actually all problematized. So if we want to think about biodiversity loss, the reason why we're getting biodiversity loss is because we're just fundamentally seeing nature as a resource and our theory of hygiene as being a modernist idea of hygiene, which is about nothing being creating vacuums. You know, the wall behind you is white, the wall behind me is white. These are ideas of hygiene. Whereas actually, and what we did, we stripped out all the microbiome of our environments, which means that actually, if you look at our human health, asthma and other things, we're increasing the rates of that. And this is an idea of how we've had to, since I would say even the 19th century and the kind of cholera pandemics and the kind of theories of, we created a theory of de-centering ourselves, distancing ourselves from the world. And that is creating some of the challenges. So I think we're in a fundamental transition, and this involves re-examining our relationship with each other and recognizing entanglement, relationship with the planet and recognizing entanglement, and a relationship with the future and recognizing our entanglement and the risks we're generating for our future. So I think you're right. It's a deep structural transition.
Yeah, and a deep learning about ourselves as humans. I had a discussion a few days ago with some climate activists, and they said was very interesting. They said that they don't have a problem with Western science, not at all. It's good, but they said they can't accept that this kind of science we do in the Western countries, or this normal science we do, and is so highlighted, and other knowledge is so downlighted. So maybe a few things you tell, they are not new in the end, but they are forgotten. So how do you think about this? Do we need to open a more spiritual way of thinking without throwing the science out, where we will come into esoteric, what else, whatever?
I'm a little bit differently minded. I suppose I think that science has already been pointing us this way for a long time. So the idea that the microbiome in your gut affects your thinking structure is not non-science, it's science. The idea that actually your social brain, you're influenced by the social brain and by of your friends and networks is not unscience. Epigenetics exists, quantum theory entanglement exists. I think the science has been showing us the way. I think we've been living in a historic science, and I think the problem is not the science. The problem is that the science has been extrapolated into social political order, which is an old social political order. It's been extrapolated to theories of objecthoods when we know that most things are processes. Our English language is largely fixated on noun structures as opposed to verb and processing structures, and the German language is better than the English in this sense. But so what you've got is how the science has been extrapolated into our social institutional frameworks, and that science is largely a Newtonian science. It's not actually 1970s quantum physics and quantum philosophy and what that was telling us, or even modern biology and what it's starting to show us in any of these frameworks. So I don't think this is a problem of science. I think that it's a problem of old science, which is buried so deeply into our institutional frames that it's created logics of dead things. So our economics is an economics of dead things, not an economics of life. It's an economic of resource rather than generative value. So I think it's an old Newtonian science, which has then been extrapolated into our economic theory, into our social constructs and our social imaginaries, which is from an old world. And that is where the crisis comes from. And I'm slightly nervous about putting this at the doorstep of science. The science has been doing the work since the 1970s onwards. So people like David Berman have spoken about this. I don't think they just absorbed it into our social imaginaries. I do think that there is a sort of a scientific frame, which is about objecthood, which needs to be challenged. But I think the entanglement theory and the enlightenment theory comes together in a powerful way. So I would say there's a two-eyed way of seeing, which is recognizing this. But science and the indigenous theories and the indigenous practices are a strong coalition. They're not at odds with each other, increasingly. I think the social political frameworks are.
So a bit like the science you told, the older science or way of making science, and it was a science without a heart. And so we had a sign how to go, and now it would be needed to fill this sign with the will of going away. Yeah. And make it metaphoric.
And I think it's, exactly. And I think it opens up all sorts of things. I think for me, it's the science has been getting here, right? The science has been seeing the entanglement. The science is seeing the entanglement at the quantum level, at the biological level. Trees are not understood as trees, but as superorganisms. I think we're starting to see the world that way. The science has always seen the world that way. I think the social political frameworks haven't. And the social political frameworks are captured by an old theory of science, a science of dead things, a Newtonian science, which is about seeing the world through objects and dead things, which I think we haven't transcended yet. So the fracture point is there, basically.
For me, a bit science is creating magic. Often people say, "Oh, don't tell me how this works, because this knowing how it works is destroying the magic." So I would say different. No, it's a magic how great things work. But let's come to another point. So as I told in the beginning, you are normally based in London, and there was a big heat wave in the July. About 40 over 40 degrees in London, and a few houses on the suburbs burning like this. And can you tell us a bit about this? Maybe personal. Maybe what was the feeling, the reaction, or maybe as an architect to say, okay, there's something visible for you, especially.
I mean, I think the key thing that's becoming clear is that how big the scale of change we're facing is, right? I think the reality is some of these projections that we're now witnessing, whether in UK, but, Portugal, Madrid, these projections were projected for 2150, 2050, 20 to 2040, and we're seeing them already.
Yeah.
So one of the things to recognize is the IPCC report was incredibly conservative, and I mean conservative as in it didn't even project a realistic figure. It was just trying to pick the most conservative figure. And those conservative figures are being outstripped. So step one. Step two is the reality that we are already seeing climate-related deaths. So if you look at excess deaths as a result of heat across Europe, Southern Europe, you're starting to see them already. This is not some future, and this is not some, it happens in the everyday. People, you know, can't sleep at night, so they get up and they go in their car and they fall asleep. You know, it happens in the everyday, small things, and we're seeing this already. It's also worth recognizing that European southern cities are losing population to European northern cities, which are gaining population. So we're seeing population shifts happening already. So then the second part is that, you know, how fine grain, whilst the human body can tolerate stuff, actually its tolerance is relatively poor in terms of actually productivity and work. So we know Northern Europe was part of an economic boom because of the climate conditions that were there, which created the fertile landscape for cognitive, complex work, because actually being in a cool environment makes that possible. So you put humans into 30, 31 degrees, try doing complex cognitive work persistently in that environment. It's much harder, which is where the role of air conditioning, which created a northern climate pretty much everywhere around the world, has been critical to the democratization of capacity, right? So I just want to acknowledge how fine-grained this stuff is. And then if you look at systemically, globally, we're seeing food baskets become fragile. We're seeing energy markets become expensive. And these are all realities as we start to. And those things, you know, we know that the major food baskets around the world become fragile at 1.5 to 1.7 degrees. Currently, there's a heat wave being projected in the US where the corn stock will most likely be killed, which will have a big issue. So we're going to start seeing global fragility. Those fragilities are manifesting in everyday lives. You're paying extra for your energy bills because energy is becoming volatile as a system. Remember that most of our energy still is coming from hydrocarbon by most, nearly 89, 90% of our energy supplies are coming from hydrocarbons. Food stocks are becoming fragile. You're paying more for your food. Your work conditions are becoming more difficult. This is happening everywhere. This climate change, and you know, if we have 2 degrees average urban environments, average temperature, urban environments might be about 6 degrees higher. So 2 degrees average is not 2 degrees in a city. It's significantly warmer in a city.
Exactly.
As a result, right? And we have our cities, northern European cities aren't designed for this. They're not designed to manage the heat well. They're not designed to. So we're seeing both also heat, but also flooding risk. So I think parts of northern Europe will see flooding, have seen flooding already, and will see more flooding. Now, I think what this manifests like, okay, so, you know, 2 days of extreme weather, you know, let's also look at the micro details of this. So UK has, I think, 30,000 kilometers of rails.
Mm-hmm.
As the temperature went up, the rails started to buckle because the UK has unstressed rails. So the rails are not stress rails as they do in certain parts of Europe, because the swing range in the UK between the cold and the hot climate is a particular swing range, which means that you end up able to use stress rails. Now, those calculations have been done on climate models of tolerances of rails. As those models change, you have to start to rethink your railway infrastructure and your rails, because they will buckle at those temperatures. So railways stopped working because you couldn't get the railways to run on the rails because they'd overheat the rails. And as soon as you overheat them, they'll buckle. You'll destroy your rail infrastructure. You'll have a crash. So and now imagine bridges. Now imagine roads. Now imagine every expansion joint. So like when we talk about this like this. But these things are based into models. Things are built based into our engineering infrastructure of a city. That all sorts of things on the table. So, yes, we can talk about the fires, but it also manifests in every other dimension. And I don't think we're being serious about the scale of the transition it means for our Europe, our civilization at every level. And I think that's what we're facing as we look forward. And that, so railways were being troubled. Yes, you had houses burning down because actually you've got massive amounts of the timber practices and the kind of forestry practices aren't there to deal with actually very fragile landscapes because it's not used to that level of dryness. So all sorts of things, bins were melting because people were putting plastics and bottles into bins, and the solar rays were so strong that they would effectively start a fire in the bin. Right. So because the bins were transparent, and the reason why the bins were transparent is to deal with terrorism reacts. They make transparent bins so you can see if anything's been put in, and that would cause. So it's everywhere. That's my point. It's every decision is being transformed.
So for sure, a big, huge thing to do. On the other hand, if it's everywhere, for sure, in a heat wave like this, it's not only the people with the burnt houses feeling it. There are so many people. Did this made a change a bit, or more understanding in the social way? Or came it maybe with the war back to normal progress, how it is?
I think the problem. So let's look at it properly. I think there's a really interesting survey done from citizens who said, do you think climate change is a real issue, right? And this was, I think it was a German city, and it was a 90% response saying, yes, it was a serious issue, right? So people often say, is this a citizen problem? No. The problem is we don't know how to transition the scale of industries and the capital investment required to make that transition. And to take out vested industries. So let's look. We're both here in Germany, and a car industry that we've got. The reality is that the future of urban mobility is not cars; it's electric bikes.
Like this, yeah.
Electric bikes, right? It's electric bikes and public transportation. Anyone who thinks that it's electric vehicles is lying to us because we don't have the material resources. We don't have the carbon base load to be able to rebuild all our carbon mobility infrastructures. We can't afford the roads, maintenance, all of this stuff. You take a total cost view of the car, from carbon, full life cycle carbon to everything else, it's electric bikes, if you look at the numbers. Yet our collective ability as a nation here to be able to say, actually, we need to transform core industries that have been at the centerpiece of our success for nearly 70 years, takes a form of courage that I think we're missing. And this is not a citizen problem. It's actually, this is where we're not having the honest conversations. And to have the honest conversations is very difficult right now. So I think there's a kind of much more fundamental question here about how we have that conversation and start to recognize the scale of what's required and to deal with the vested interests. So, and the vested interest problem is really important because people have vested their careers, their capital, their futures, their children's wealth into some of these futures. And we're going to have to unpick that vested future and that lock-in if we're, as a society, going to make difficult decisions. And I think that's a really important question and a really important problem that I think we have to deal with. And historically, we've had to deal with these lock-ins at a different level. And I think that's really important. So when the UK tried to abolish slavery in 1833, they basically compensated slave owners and to effectively abolish slavery. They said, right, and that compensation was done, morally really problematic, but it was done so that because slavery was financed through banks. So when they compensated the slave owners could then pay back the banks the loans that they owed, which means the banks wouldn't fail, which meant the banks could recapitalize could recapitalize industry. So we're going to have to systemically break the lock-ins that we have in society at large scale. And I think we as a society have forgotten that our capacity as societies to make these scale of decisions. We work at the edge of markets. The failure of markets is what we operate in, rather than recognizing that we have to sometimes reframe markets more fundamentally and restructure societal decisions. And we have to rebuild our capacity to be able to think that and to build the legitimacy of that in a new form of democratic mandate that has to be constructed. And that democratic mandate has to be not constructed through the vote, but building our collective sensing of this future.
So with the bikes and the cars, it's a bit the same that you have a big sort of industry, the cars, and you swap it to the bike, so you have a loss. For sure, we have to face the idea of not growing all the time, to grow. No, it's the slavery we have at the moment, that the people say you have to grow, not mental, not personal, but financial and economical.
Dominic, can I just say that I think there's a different theory of growth here. It's not that we don't have to grow. We have to degrow certain things, right? So if we degrow our car economies, we might regrow our personal health. We might regrow, actually, a new micro-local economy as a result of the biking infrastructure. We might regrow, actually, the maintenance and road repair costs. We might regrow our regenerative ecological frames because we don't need that many roads of that size. So that means we can actually grow our biodiversity, which might regrow, our healthcare. So I think it's a rebound. So our current theory of growth has been linked through material resource consumption. And I think we have to have an expanded theory of growth, which is actually broader than that, looking at a deeper theory of human development and growth. And I think that transition is critical. So I don't think it's about growth versus degrowth, because I think currently we're in degrowth. Currently, the social environmental costs are greater than the profits extracted, right? So the profits are less than the social environment costs generated. We are in degrowth. I think what we have to talk about is a deeper theory of growth. And I think that requires a new relationship with our material economy, reducing our material economy, because we can't afford that level of imprint. If we're going to have any form of just world, we're going to make it circular, we're going to make it durable, we're going to have to grow our biodiversity, our foundational base, we're going to have to grow our intangibles. So we have to change, we have to put a human development, our cognitive inner development, as a key part of our growth theory. So how do you put humans and human development on the balance sheet of a nation? I think that becomes a really powerful asset or even a corporation. That becomes a key asset as opposed to just material asset. So currently, you or me, we're working in a corporation, we're a cost, whereas actually the table is an asset. The table doesn't produce shit without you or me. So the reality is, how do we reframe these accounting models and to understand and put life at the center of these things and value generation at the center of these things in new ways? So I'm less about saying degrowth, definitely degrowth of our current material economy, but I think we have to build a new capacity of growth and human development.
Maybe a growth like a next step of humanity, coming from the childish grabbing a next step to a more adult interacting with the world and ourselves in the end. So,
agree.
Is there a door to bring people together, as you told in the beginning, in the urban situations, to bring more, not only the people together, to bring more ideas, diversity of ideas together, only in building or thinking cities different?
I mean, for me, cities are at the forefront of the crisis, because the energy issue, the food issue, the heat issues, the flooding issues, the health issues, the cities are at the integral intersection of these issues. So cities are going to be at the front end of this problem domain. I think the big problem that we have is that the solution to this problem domain is an integral solution. So it's not about saying you solve the retrofit problem, then you solve the food problem, and then you solve the health problem separately. Is that these problems have to be solved at an integral level. And we're going to be almost certainly living in a new productive economy in terms of actually the role of automation and certain other factors. So I think one of the key things for cities is, how do you solve and address these problems through an integral lens, and building the capacity to look at that. And that opens up whole new solution domains. So when you're doing a retrofit of a whole city is not about energy. It's about energy, health, all sorts of other secondary outcomes, which are really critical. So I think one of the key dimensions is building the bureaucratic and the kind of transitional capacity to look at these problems from an intersectional lens. Second is, like, it's a new domain of problems. So how do cities see the mental health of a city? How do we see the benefit of a tree canopy. The benefit of a tree canopy is all sorts of issues across, like I said, heat island and flooding. All these other issues come to the table in a different format. So I think this looking at new assets, which are intersectional assets, looking at how we do existing programs from an intersectional way, and then looking at intangible assets at the city scale, like mental health is not an individual problem, but a collective societal challenge in terms of how we reduce some of the kind of stresses on people's cognitive capacities. And I think we need to build cities' capacities to be able to deal with that. And I think that's a really key part of the steering solution. So I think cities are at the intersection of the challenges, but also at an intersection of a new class of responses. And we have to build that capability. And that's going to be really fundamental. And the reason, one of the other things we have to recognize, and this goes back to mobility, if you want to, say, turn a whole city into built on electric bikes, expect electric cars, right? Let's imagine you do that. The benefits are not at the cost of transactions. There's a cost of transaction, the cost of a car versus cost of a bike. There's cost of materials, there's cost of carbon. There's the cost of the road infrastructure you have to maintain for cars. There's a cost of health implications that you have in terms of air pollution, in terms of noise pollution that you impact. So you have to take a total system view of the cost. And cities can start to take that total system view that an individual car owner never can. So how do you take this landscape level to system level cost view and system level benefit view, which means there's new classes of value to be uncovered at that way. And I think that, and the challenge is to be able to unlock that value, which is an aggregate value, not an individual value. We have to create a new form of legitimacy and a new form of trust and these kind of aggregate institutions, and these collective institutions, as new forms of aggregate institutions. And that, I think, is a big leap for us as well.
To come a bit back to the decide-making politicians, do you say it's much needed from the logic part, from the part of what you have to know to do such decisions, sometimes too much for one politician. So what would you say is this a good angle to say, okay, hey, we have to implement more different people into such decisions, or more professionality with more of you? So,
my intuition is that it's not about more. It's not about more expert-driven capacities, but it's about citizen-driven capacities. So, I've been fortunate enough to be, doing conversations on the ground, and what I found fascinating was the capacity for citizens, everyday citizens, literally 90-year-old, 80-year-old men, women, to, at an embodied level, at a sense of feeling it level, understand these conversations. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to create and people often say, people won't get these conversations, but they do at an embodied level. Everyone knows that, if you pick up a fork, the idea of having a fork or a spoon for 49 cent is crazy. Like, you have to mine the iron, you have to convert it into steel, you have to process it, you have to move it everywhere, then get it delivered. But people at an embodied level, know the unreality of that. And I think what we have to do is create the frameworks for the citizen movement. I think this requires not just expert-level development, but actually a new citizen conversation at ground level and building. And that will create the landscape for politicians, the Overton window, for politicians to move. So I think, yes, politicians, but also it's the citizen conversation. And that has to be, I was part of a festival in the middle of Birmingham, and it was extraordinary, these layers of conversation. So how do you build the groundswell of these conversations across Germany and across other parts of the DAC region that is actually situated in being able to have these deliberative conversations? A network of these conversations across Germany would be amazing in over a weekend, like almost like a festival. If you did have 10,000, 20,000 conversations, I think what that would do for actually the politics of change.
It's
genuinely deliberative.
It's called Bürgerrat. We have a kind of idea like this. Maybe you heard about in German. It's not at the moment. It's not on the big scale, but a few here and there happening, and they were very nice. There was, as you say, there was. Hilarious good ideas coming out. and ideas that will work, not only funny things, so really, really working things, and non-professionals, but a mixture of different citizens. Maybe it's really new. I've seen a trailer about it. Maybe you've seen it. I think so. It's the Line concept from Saudi Arabia. You've heard about?
Yeah.
How do you bring this in a scale? Because it's in the first moment you see, oh, it's CO2 neutral, and for sure you have all these nice sounding and picture in the trailer. But how do you? Is this the end of one kind of? Dictatoric people pressing variation of a city of climate change?
So, I think different civilizations have different viewpoints of how to construct futures. I think what Europe uniquely brings to the world is the democratization of how we make cities. And the democratization of making cities is fundamentally an orchestra. This is why I think systems change is really important for democracies, because systems are not management models, they're not control models, they're about cooperation models, they're about recognizing interdependencies, they require distributed consciousness and capabilities. They're not impositions of a single linear plan or a single model. I think at European level we have a unique opportunity to build a different way of looking into the future, which is about the mass participation of making, democratizing the act of how we make society. And that is not only, that's not about just the vote, but a much deeper participation and the cognitive participation of ourselves with society. Now, I think there's a really interesting question about if a city is a piece of infrastructure, and what do we need to democratize, and what is the interface that we need to build to democratize it, and what do we need to provide as infrastructure and service, and if we do, how do we make sure there's democratic capability around it? So I think the challenge, and the other part is that the reality is, you know, London, you can't rebuild a London.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
although we might have to in another 40, 50 years. The reality is the materials that we've invested into all of our cities and the time and landscape we've invested into our cities is huge. So we're going to have to adapt and vary our cities at an extreme rate, because we don't have the carbon budgets to rebuild all of our cities. Right? So I think that Europe has a different transition. We have to be able to reimagine and redeploy our material energy stocks that we've invested in the building of our cities, and to find new 21st century versions of living in them. And that's our challenge. And I suppose places like Saudi and other places in the world which are looking, you know, remember there are going to be 1.2 billion people on the move, most likely with climate change. So we will see new cities. Most of those cities will be slums, right? Most of those cities will be slums and informal settlements. The question is, so there is going to be a whole question about new city design that I think will come to the table. And the question is, how do we want to do it? Do we see the city as a service, which is a, and does the risk of city as a service become a fundamental problem because it creates rent-seeking capacity, it creates autocratic frameworks, which means that actually, and the problem with autocracies is they, you know, one of the best things that somebody told me was that the best thing about democracies is democracies correct their mistakes quicker. Democracies correct their mistakes quicker. It's not that we make the best decisions. We just correct mistakes at a higher rate. So the error correction rate is higher in democracies than autocracies, autocratic systems. Whereas autocracies might, and this is, I think, really important. So like in cancer, it's almost our ability to correct things is more critical than our ability to make the perfect decision. And so democracies are, and how do we build that capacity to make mistakes and correct? London is what it is, and many other cities around the world are what they are, is because they've corrected mistakes for nearly 1,000 years. Right?
Yeah.
It's a 1,000-year correction process.
Yeah, it's interesting because often people say that, or you hear and there, you hear that the autocratics are easy, can better react to climate change because they can use their people as slaves. So in the end, but there's a good point with this correction of problems of mistakes, because it's much more flexibility, and that is a core product of acting with a crisis is flexibility. Is this maybe an underrated power?
Yeah, volatility, right? So if we're living in a volatile, uncertain world, our capacity to correct and recorrect becomes really important, which is why democracies have to build the trust for agile reactive systems. That is what the power of a deep democracy is. Not a voter democracy, not a four-year fixed linear industrial democracy, but a deep idea of democracy can have that unique power. And that requires us to reimagine democracy in a deep sense if we're going to make this transition.
We see the same with Ukraine and Russia at the moment, that some people choose the easy way and say, okay, let the Ukrainians die, they should give up, then we have it warm in winter. And other people say, no, help them. And those decisions are deep. And to make these decisions on a wide scale, you need to inspire. That's the point. You need to inspire people. What do you say? Is this one of the core movements we need to inspire people for a new world? Because there's so much afraidness about what's coming with climate change, for sure.
For me, it's about enlightened self-interest. And, you know, it is about how we take a deep view of value and deep view and time-based view. So you could turn around and say the best thing is X or best thing is Y. But the reality is acquiescing to Russia might make us much more vulnerable systemically in the next round, right? So there is a deeper, there's this winter, then there's the next 20 winters, right? And the question is often, or what short-term versus long-term is more critical than actually, and I think getting people to look at longitudinal value becomes really important, and building the incentives for societies and citizens to think through longitudinal values. And one of our biggest challenges is that our societal decision-making structures have been biased towards short-termism. So how do we start to think long-term? How do we start to think over the next 100 years? So one of the things we've been talking about is, how do you have a parliament for 100 years? Imagine a second house, or the federal second house or third house being actually a 100-year house based on sortation. And the role of that parliament was to check every policy for its 100-year implications. So how do we stretch our democracy's decision-making models to look at a 100-year life? Because it would have a different theory. It would have a different way of looking at those problem domains. And I think we have to stretch our capacities to look longitudinally. And longitudinally, our interests align. Over time, our interests align. Short-term, they are divergent because of particular context, but over time, they align. And that's a really critical frame.
One thing in the end. So we had, all we talked about is a bit from the view of people in the age, in the positions where like this and that can make decisions now, or maybe in the next 2-3 years, where it's very important. What would you say to younger people, where they have to go with their mind maybe and with the power they have, because young people have power, but they don't have the time maybe to grow up, to go in politics, in economics, and so on, and 20 years later doing solving problems. Because if it's not solved then, there's bigger problems. How catching them?
I mean, my big advice right now to somebody who's young is everything you see around you is but largely a zombie economy. It's dead. 68% of it is probably non-viable into the new world. You know, I think the S&P 100, if you price social environmental costs, 68% of it is non-viable. Right? So I think the stat comes from. What that starts to say is that the future is going to have a completely different theory of value. Embrace yourself not to be trapped by the values of the late 20th century, but to imagine what will have value in the 21st century. And I think that might be completely different. It goes back to our conversation about growth. What does growth really look like in the 21st century? And I don't think growth is, you know, returning to some medieval idyllic village of us sitting, us sitting in the field making bread. And everything else has disappeared and there's no wind turbines because we don't like wind turbines. I think the theory of growth is going to be different. It's going to be a new singularity between the planet at a planetary scale between the ecological systems, machine systems, and human systems. I think we need deep reimagination of what that future looks like and what human development really looks like in that future. And I would really encourage people to start to explore that new value, because I think there's going to be vast value created. I don't mean monetary value, but all sorts of value created as we walk into it. So I think the privilege of youth right now is you are unencumbered by the lock-ins of the 20th century. Use that unencumbered reality to explore what the future really holds and pass yourself into that world.
Yeah, and there maybe it's not positive, but you can use the situation. If a stable system is going unstable, you need to do those things to exactly. Explore. And that's coming, that's sure. Yeah, Indy, so if you have some last word you want to bring the crowd, greeting somewhere.
Firstly, my absolute pleasure for being here, and thank you so much for inviting me to be part of this conversation. It's a real honor. And thank you for hosting these conversations. It's really important. And I look forward to all feedback and always entertain good conversations that are necessary to build this debate. And like I say, this is one perspective. I don't want anyone to feel like what I'm saying is the truth, because I don't think anyone can see the truth. We can just see a dimension. And this is a contribution to a whole suite of podcasts that you're doing. So I hope it contributes to the greater debate that you're building, Dominic. Thank you.
Indeed. Thank you for communication.